From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in this week for Suzette Grelot, and welcome to Worldviews. Today I'll talk with three activists for both domestic and international causes. Chenjerai Kumunika teaches and studies communication at Clemson University in South Carolina and once had a career as a successful hip-hop artist.
And sometimes using words according to the traditional rules of prose can't capture everything. You got to put them together in ways that don't seem like they make sense.
His wife, Sadaka Lundi, is also an activist who focuses on women's issues.
It's a different thing teaching about the subject matter than being there.
And Diana Poole is a University of Missouri student who's dedicated her life to African-American issues.
I've been a member of NAACP since the age of 2. Started organizing at the age of 6.
Our conversation is coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in for Suzette Grelot, who will be back in the studio next week. I'm joined by three guests today who will all focus on domestic and international issues of race and gender. Chenjerai Kumunika is an assistant professor of communication at Clemson University, but once rapped in a hip-hop group called The Spooks that was successful in England. His wife, Sadaka Lundi, is also at Clemson, where she lectures on women's leadership. Ayanna Poole is one of the leaders of Concerned Student 1950, a group active during last year's racial tensions on the University of Missouri campus. That number refers to 1950, the year Mizzou's undergraduate courses were integrated. Well, I'm joined in the studio by three really impressive activists, a husband and wife, and then a young activist here. So let me talk with you, Chenjerai and Sadaka. You guys are a married couple. You have spent your life really devoted to bringing awareness to a variety of issues, to empowerment, and have been lifelong activists. Can you talk a little bit about your path?
Well, you know, I would say that I got a lot from my parents in terms of a commitment to service, which is kind of how I think they understood it. My father was a civil rights, you know, organizer who worked, you know, he actually led the Bronx chapter of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. My mother does really important work in terms of health and public health that focuses on some of the cultural aspects of those problems and racial disparities. So, you know, I got to see at a young age those different ways of intervening, and it was sort of an unspoken agreement in my family that, you know, you can do whatever you want as long as you're helping people, you know. And so I got introduced that way.
And for me, my path is a little different. I've always been involved in the community in many different ways. You know, I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I've traveled to many different countries in Africa and have been to Palestine and stayed in a refugee camp and into Haiti and have seen a lot of injustice and have in the past I've done a lot of work to create programs. I developed the Women's Empowerment Program in South Africa, did leadership development work in Haiti, and but doing the protesting work that we've been doing recently, that's been a little bit different. Since I've been with Chenjerai, I've moved more into that space. So, and, you know, I mean, after just learning about the issues, we just felt called to go out to Ferguson, for example, after just seeing all that the young people were enduring, you know, the tear gas and all that. So we felt like we needed to go and be in solidarity with them. For me, I realized after we did our first protest, you know, it takes a lot more to you know, it's a different thing teaching about the subject matter than being there, right? So I had to, because I had a lot of fear initially that I had to overcome. So it's been, I've grown a lot throughout the process. I'm still growing and still trying to figure out my role in this space. So all of this is actually quite new for me, too. So I'm you know, learning as I'm going.
Well, it's really interesting. You both have focused on youth, and obviously that's how we get cultural change, as we develop programs for youth, change the process, empowerment. And I love that you mentioned your work in South Africa, Haiti, and Palestine. Can you maybe talk a little bit about what you were doing with the women there, young women?
And so as a Peace Corps volunteer, I worked at a youth leadership center in Rustenburg, in a northwest province of South Africa. And one of the things that I noticed immediately was that the population that we served was very diverse, but it was mainly youth from middle to upper class families. So I talked to the director and tried to see if there was a way that we can extend our participant base to reach out to youth in the rural communities. especially having lived with the host family in the village somewhere, and I recognize all the problems that my host sister was experiencing in a community, and just the lack of resources and opportunities to do different things. There were no after-school programs and things like that. So I wanted to see more people like my host sister take part in this leadership work that we were providing, you know, the more, I guess, wealthier student population.
And I'm curious, you have this international experience and the experience of women abroad and youth abroad. How do you relate that to youths here, the situation domestically? Are there similarities?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say is, you know, if you look at the situation that just happened with the Panama Papers, This is really confirming something that in a particular kind of way, with a particular kind of information about the practices of this bank and people avoiding paying taxes. You know, I think even from a storytelling perspective, we need to really be clear what we mean when we talk about people avoiding taxes. We're talking about tremendous trillions of dollars of public resources that could have gone to solving some of our most pressing problems. So I think that that's a global problem, and people are responding to it in a variety of different ways. I think that so many of the problems that we see here, when you see people uprising, you know, I mean, if you look at problems of, you know, what's happening in the, you know, sort of what I hate to even play into the idea of urban crime as though there's some type of crime is only in urban areas. But if you talk about poverty, like the kind of things that you saw in like Freddie Gray's neighborhood in Baltimore or in Ferguson, you know, there's a way in which you can look at that as deeply connected to the things we're seeing in the Panama Papers. But also, if you look at the situation people are, you know, dealing with in Greece, right, and where they've been the victim of, you know, policies of austerity, you know. And so I think people are rising up all around the world in response to that. But one other thing I want to say that's dangerous is there's also a different kind of populism that's at work globally, and that is the xenophobia aspect where you have, you know, people who are trying, you know, you have people who are maybe not as educated on some of these dynamics or for different reasons vulnerable to thinking that the cause of their problem is other people who are often tend to be brown people, you know, or people of a different, you know, people who are Muslim or something like that. So you see that. I mean, even in a place that we tend to often idolize or fantasize about when we look at, like, you know, Scandinavia as a socialist kind of utopia. But the reality is, even there, this problem of xenophobia is still there for folks who feel like they're not getting their fair shake. So all those kinds of populism, I think, are present. You see, in a lot of ways, our election is like a sort of petri dish where you can see all those things going on, but they definitely connect to global trends.
Absolutely. And speaking of protest and getting on the grounds this last fall, we, of course, all heard about the situation in Missouri at the university there. And so we are joined by Ayanna here, who is one of the leaders, motivators, and mobilizers there. If you could maybe tell us a little bit about your story and your call to action and exactly what you did.
Our call to action, or my personal call to action, was long before university. I've been around for a while. I've been a member of NAACP since the age of 2. Started organizing at the age of 6. Actually, under the NAACP unit in my hometown, my great-grandfather was the president. And at the age of, I believe actually I was 5 when he was like, I want you to do a program, start working on it. And I was like, what is a program? And so actually what I did was I was basically an educator for the little girls and little boys around me because I had that background knowledge living with him. He's an activist, or was an activist. And I read books that I had no idea what the words were. He consistently educated me on the state of blacks across America, because in my hometown, you don't really see the issues. And so I was educated at a young age, and I started a program where it's basically peer education for youth. And so the children that are deeply involved actually still do that program. I have a little girl who's 8 years old who educates children around her. She basically has a class every Thursday, which is the cutest thing ever. And so, yeah, that was actually my first step into organization, being a peer educator at the age of 6. Crazy to think about. And then, you know, you go through this stage when you're like in your teenage years where you don't really know what you want to do. So I kind of backed away from organizing. I was still active in the community, still doing a lot of work with Boys and Girls Clubs, the local ones. But then it wasn't until I got to college that I moved back into activism. And I actually started doing activism through art, through the art of poetry. And so discussing all of these issues across the nation through poetics. And then you have Ferguson happening, and Ferguson is an hour and a half away from the University of Missouri's campus. And then you kind of have this post-Ferguson effect that begins happening. And that was my step back into the realm of actually organizing. And so you have four queer black women at the University of Missouri's campus begin MU for Mike Brown. And so basically it was a transformation of that energy from Ferguson to the University of Missouri's campus. And how do you use that energy in order to actually fight an institution? And at the end of the day, we're all fighting different institutions within the same system, which I will reiterate a lot. How do we do that in an educational institution? And then that's when the fight began at the University of Missouri. And we've been active since MU for Mike Brown. All of the women actually graduated, and that's where Concerned Student 1950 began, even though all of us were active organizers for MU for Mike Brown.
And just to remind folks that may not remember the details, we're talking about the situation at the University of Missouri where racial comments were made, threatening comments were made, and the administration appeared to not act appropriately, and this led to a number of protests and eventually the ouster of the president following the boycott by the football team, I believe it was. So that entire process you're involved in, you're getting people out, you're noticing the injustice of the institution there as it related to Ferguson, which really called you back to action.
I think the most important part of the call back to action, or the call to action for especially for a lot of campuses, is it's actually not what happens from student to student. It's not about being called derogatory statements. It's about what policies are in place that allows these things to happen. And if you look at universities, the head controls the body. So if you have a president who is incompetent, he allows his administration to be incompetent. And then you have faculty and staff who reproduce these systems of oppression. And then the students are allowed to do it. And they get smacks on the wrist. So what is it that allows people to do that? Why do students have the goal to do it and they feel protected if they do call students these names, or if they draw a swastika on the restroom wall, as you see happening at the University of Missouri? What's in place to make them feel comfortable and feel like that is okay? So it's usually not actually what's happening from student to student. It's what else is there. What else is going on the university's campus, and those are campuses across the nation that reproduce the systems of oppression.
But one thing that I've noticed, and you know, Ayanna brings up a really good point, is that the focus on incidents. I mean, incidents are useful in some ways for organizers to illustrate, to take that incident and be able to tell a story about a larger pattern. But, you know, there's also sometimes are used in a different ways by administrations to try to characterize what really is a deep structural problem embedded in policy, embedded in years of culture, as an isolated incident. And then to then pose as a strategy, as a solution to that, you know, scapegoating a few individuals, apologies, you know. I mean, an apology is an interesting thing as it's and I think this applies to context beyond obviously campus activism, but like these apologies with racial incidents, right? I mean, sometimes I don't necessarily want a quick, like the apology and a crucial part of the apology is always, I wasn't acting, you know, out of my own, you know, it was just like a bad moment. And I'm like, well, no, you know, that these things aren't bad moments. It's like, I in a way, before the apology, I really would like to see a prolonged discussion as to where this came from, and a prolonged introspection and sort of outrospection, collective, you know, reflection on what this is. And so that the move to a rush for an apology, I think, is interesting. And then that is connected to policy surface kind of solution.
I've been talking with Chenjerai Kumanyika, Ayanna Poole, and Sadaka Lundi about some of their domestic and international activism. More of our conversation right after a short break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm filling in for Suzette Gerlot. She's back in the U.S., and we'll have her in the studio next week. When we left off, my guests Chenjerai Kumanyika and Ayanna Poole were telling me about their activism at the University of Missouri during last year's racial unrest on campus. And we aren't hearing that much about what's going on there now. Can you maybe give us an update of what's happened since?
Since then, you have the state of Missouri defunding the University of Missouri systems. Actually, in the last month, they agreed to fund the other universities and not fund the University of Missouri. So now we have a lot of issues with budget that are happening, where to place money, allocation of funds, where are we getting the funds. And you have a lot of boosters who are also taking funds away from the university. You have boosters who are taking funds because they're not protecting black students. And then you have boosters taking funds because why did you let the black students protest? So they have people coming from every way. And then you have a 30% decrease in admissions. You have two dormitories that will not open in the fall. You have a lot of students transferring out of the university. You have them putting in place programs or putting in place positions, but not actually, it's actually like pacifying the students to say, hey, look what we're doing, and they're actually not doing anything. They have this thing called the working group for students to come to, and the way that it was explained originally was the working group would be so we could get it was a collective of ideas, people with from all backgrounds, all cultures, from a lot of different organizations across campus, and it was where we could express ideas together. But now actually what you see in the working group is them telling us, well, this is what is in place, and this is what you can and cannot do. And I'm pretty sure that the students aren't the people that need a working group. I'm pretty sure it's administrators that need the working group. So you have a lot of that, and you have a lot of blaming us for everything. Actually, every issue that's happened at the University of Missouri is being blamed on Concerned Student 1950, but the issues are still there. So we're still working.
And faculty.
Oh, the faculty, our faculty is phenomenal, especially our black faculty. But we have some faculty that need a working group also. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about like Melissa Click.
Yeah, like Melissa, who is actually no longer faculty. Melissa was actually fired this year. Actually, the University of Missouri is actually allowing legislators to have like a big hand in everything that's happening where they don't have a hand at. Our governing body of board of curators, who basically oversee most of the things that happen within the university system, they are actually all legislators. And so they go back and they listen to their friends and they come back and they say, well, this is what we're going to do for the university. But none of these people have educational background.
So it's those larger structural issues that you're talking about.
Yeah.
and more and more attempts at quick fixes that mm-hmm. aren't quick fixes.
Yeah.
And it sounds like your work continues. One thing that you mentioned that I also wanted to ask Chenjerai about is the use of art. The use of art in activism. You were actually a member of a hip-hop band back in the day, and I know all of you have used art to spread messages, and I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about the power of art.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's always, you know, I mean, that is a little bit of a dialogue and conversation, and so there's a way in which art, not to go all scholarly on you, but there's a sort of symbolic efficiency that art has where you can just, you know, articulate things in art that, you know, we don't like language. We have a lot of words in English language, but words can't capture everything, you know. And sometimes using words according to the traditional rules of prose can't capture everything. You got to put them together in ways that don't seem like they make sense, but then they wind up making much deeper sense. I just want to give a concrete example. And I know Ayanna started as a poet, she's mentioned in some ways. But on Clemson's campus, there was a graduate student named A.D. Carson wrote a poem and made a video called See the Stripes. And he used that poem to unveil a really deep engagement with Clemson's history. You know, Clemson is situated on a plantation of John C. Calhoun, mm-hmm. who was one of the foremost leaders of the Confederacy and creator of and signer of the Fugitive Slave Act and things like this. And so, and then also Clemson's icons are people like Strom Thurmond and Ben Pitchfork Tillman. So there's like this crazy history. And in some ways, you can look and see a line of continuity, right? Like Clemson has integrated and after being sued, although Clemson says that they integrated with dignity, but the integrated with dignity seems to, but what really is like, you know, Harvey Gantt had to sue Clemson to get in. And so there's like a certain lines of continuity. And I just, you know, so the, his poem was really the thing that set that off, to see the stripes. I mean, and then from there they made T-shirts and it really became a sort of counter way. And I think that created more room for a lot of people at Clemson who didn't see themselves in that sort of solid orange metaphor, solid orange family, you know, and they were able to come in through the see the stripes thing.
And Ayanna, you said you were a poet, and that's how you've been able to articulate some of these issues as well.
Mm-hmm. So my quote for most of my poetry is, "I wrote for you so you live forever, even if I don't." And I think that that's the biggest thing when it comes to art forms, because art forms last, many art forms last forever. Essentially, you create a legacy for someone and also for yourself. But I'm more more intrigued by what the actual work says and what the work actual work does for other people. People take from art what they want to. You can have a million messages within it, but what someone needs in that moment is what they're going to take. And so I find myself in a lot of spaces that I normally wouldn't feel comfortable in, but releasing this poetry, which I don't do often anymore, but releasing this poetry to people that don't look like me, because it's actually one of my only ways of engaging that conversation and having these people actually understand where I'm coming from and seeing my pain as a Black woman. Because when I say it in a classroom, it's just like, oh, okay, I've heard it, I've seen it in books, I know you went through slavery, I know all of this. But once they actually hear me expressing these things and showing the pain of the Black community and showing the pain of marginalized communities, I've had many people walk up to me afterwards like, oh my God, I didn't know it was that bad. And it's like, yeah, it was that bad before the poem. And so art has been my way of starting these conversations with other people, and also introducing new concepts to people that they're unfamiliar with, or introducing incidents. Like I talk about Ayanna Jones a lot. Ayanna Jones was a 9-year-old child who was killed by police brutality. And I talk about her a lot. She's like my spirit child. And I introduce like how this is a problem through incidents such as that, or talking about what happened in Charleston. With Charleston, and actually digging into, like, because you have these people who die. But nobody knows who they are. Nobody knows their stories. And so what I try to do through my poetry when it comes to activism is actually showing that story of that individual.
To humanize.
To humanize them.
Those are all very, very good messages, I think, for activists here domestically, and even maybe even more so when you're dealing internationally, getting involved in nonprofits and NGOs. Well, I really hate to break this up, but we are unfortunately coming to the end of our time. But this has just been a fantastic discussion. And I wish we could stay longer, but I really want to thank you, all three of you, for joining us today and sharing your stories, experiences, and insights. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Chenjerai Kumanyika, Sadaka Lodi, and Ayanna Poole about their domestic and international activism. You can download this interview and all of our past episodes from KGOU.org or subscribe to our podcast. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our audio and digital editor is Brian Hardzinski. Sam Dupree produces the show, and Miranda Wilson oversees our research. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and thanks for listening.